Chapter 2. In a Railway Carriage. Frenchmen are not rational and would consider themselves most unfortunate if they were. This phrase was written by Van Wiesen as far back as the last century, and heavens, how cheerfully he must have written it. I bet the sheer joy of it warmed the cockles of his heart when he was thinking it up. And who knows, perhaps all of us coming after Van Wiesen, 3 or 4 generations at a stretch, read it not without pleasure. All such phrases, which put foreigners in their place, contain, even if we come across them now, something irresistibly pleasant for us Russians. We keep this very secret sometimes, even secret from ourselves. For there are in this certain overtones of revenge for an evil past. Maybe this is a bad feeling, but somehow I am convinced it exists in almost every one of us. Naturally enough, we kick up a fuss if we are suspected of it, and are not one bit insincere, and yet I should imagine Bielinski himself was in this sense a Slavophile. I remember about 15 years ago, when I knew Bielinski, how reverently, sometimes even oddly so, all that set used to bow down and worship the West, mostly France, that is. France was all the fashion then. This was in 1946. And it is not that people adored such names as Georges Sand, Proudhon, etc., and felt respect for those of Louis Blanc, Le Dru Rollin, and others. Oh, no. People thought highly even of little pipsqueaks, bearing the most wretched names, who simply collapsed when they were put on their mettle later on. Even those were expected to perform great deeds in the future service to humanity. Some of them were talked about in a special reverent whisper. And what do you think? In all my life I have never seen a man more passionately Russian than was Bielinski, though before him only Tchardaev perhaps spoke with such bold and sometimes blind indignation about much in our native land, and apparently despised everything Russian. There are certain reasons why I should remember and think of it now. But who knows? Maybe Bielinski himself did not always consider that mo of Van Wiesen's particularly scandalous. Surely there are moments when people fail to appreciate the most seemly and indeed legitimate tutelage. Oh, but for heaven's sake, don't run away with the idea that to love one's country means to revile the foreigner, or that I think it does. I don't think so at all, and have no intention of thinking so, on the contrary even. Only it is a pity I have no time to explain myself somewhat more clearly. By the way, please don't think that I have forgotten Paris and launched myself into Russian literature instead, or that I am writing an article of literary criticism. It's only because I have nothing else to do. My diary tells me that I am now sitting in a railway carriage, and am getting ready to see Eitkühnen tomorrow, to receive, that is, my first impression of a foreign country, and my heart even misses a beat occasionally. Shall I really see Europe at last? I, who have vainly dreamt of it for almost 40 years, I, who, when still only 16, in dead earnest and like Nekrasov's Bielopiatkin, wished to flee to Switzerland, but did not flee, and am now about to enter the land of holy miracles, the land for which I have yearned so long, and from which I expected so much, and in which I believed so implicitly. Good heavens, I kept thinking as I sat in the railway carriage, how can we be called Russians? Are we really Russians, in fact? Why does Europe make such a powerful and magic impression on all of us, whoever we are? Why does it appeal to us so much? I don't mean to those Russians who stay at home, those ordinary Russians whose name is 50 million, on whom we, all the 100,000 of us, look with disdain, and whom our profound satirical journals make fun of because they do not shave their beards. No, I mean our privileged and patented little group. After all, everything, literally almost everything we can show, which may be called progress, science, art, citizenship, humanity, everything, everything stems from there, from that land of holy miracles. The whole of our life, from earliest childhood, is shaped by the European mould. Could any one of us have withstood this influence, appeal, pressure? How is it that we have still not been finally metamorphosed into Europeans? And I think everyone will agree that we have not been metamorphosed, some with pleasure, others, of course, with fury, because we have not yet reached metamorphosis. But that is another matter. I am merely speaking about the fact that we have not been metamorphosed even after being subjected to such an overwhelming influence, and am at a loss to account for it. It could surely not have been our nannies and mammies that have preserved us from metamorphosis. It is sad and absurd, really, to think that but for Arina Rodionovna, Pushkin's nurse, we should, perhaps, have had no Pushkin. That is nonsense, is it not? Of course it is. And what if, in fact, it is not nonsense? Many Russian children are now being brought up in France. What if another Pushkin had been taken there to be deprived from his cradle upwards both of an Arina Rodionovna and of Russian speech? No one could have been more Russian than Pushkin. Though himself of gentle birth, he yet understood Pugachev and penetrated right into his innermost being at a time when nobody penetrated anywhere. An aristocrat, he yet carried Belkin within his soul. By the force of his artistry, he renounced his class, and in Onegin, judged it with stern judgment from the standpoint of a nation as a whole. He is a prophet and a forerunner. Is there really a chemical bond between the human spirit and a man's native land which makes it impossible to break away from one's country, and even if one does break away from it, makes one come back to it in the end? After all, Slavophilism did not fall in our midst straight out of the clear sky, and though it did afterwards become a Muscovite fad, the basis of this fad is considerably broader than allowed for by Moscow's formula, and lies possibly much deeper in some people's hearts than seems likely at first sight. In fact, even in Moscow, this basis is perhaps broader than Moscow's own formula. It is at first so terribly difficult to express oneself clearly, even to oneself. Some ideas, though powerful and full of vitality, take over 3 generations fully to manifest themselves, so that their final end does not resemble their beginnings in the very slightest. Thus did all these idle thoughts assail me in my railway carriage on the way to Europe, partly in spite of myself, and partly because I was bored and had nothing to do. To be frank, only those of us who have nothing to do have hitherto given thought to this sort of thing. Oh, how boring it is to sit idly in a railway carriage. In fact, just as boring as it is to live in Russia without having anything specific to do. You may be taken along and cared for. You may even be lulled to sleep sometimes. Indeed, your every wish may be anticipated. But you are bored, bored all the same, and precisely because you are being cared for and all you have to do is sit and wait till you are brought to your destination. Honestly, one sometimes feels like jumping out of the carriage and running along by the side of the engine on one's own flat feet. The results may be worse, lack of practice may soon tire one out, but at least one would be using one's own legs and doing a job one has found oneself. And were the carriage to collide and turn somersaults, one would not be sitting shut in and twirling one's thumbs, and one would not be answerable for someone else's blunder. What extraordinary ideas one gets when one has nothing to do. In the meantime, night was drawing on. Lights were being lit in the carriages. I had a husband and wife sitting opposite me, elderly people, landowners, and probably respectable. They were in a hurry to get to London for the exhibition, but only for a few days, and they had left their family at home. Sitting next to me on my right was a Russian who had been working in an office in London for the last 10 years, who had come to St. Petersburg on business for just a fortnight, and who seemed to have lost all sense of longing for his native land. On my left sat a clean, purebred Englishman, intensely serious and with his red hair parted in the English way. Throughout the journey, he never said a single word in any language to any of us. He read all day, without lifting his head, a book of that very small English print which only English people can tolerate, and even praise for its convenience, and at precisely 10 o'clock at night he took off his boots and put on slippers. He was probably used to doing this all his life, and had no desire to change his habits, even in a railway carriage. Soon everyone was dozing. The whistling and knocking sounds of the train made one terribly sleepy. I sat and thought and thought, and somehow, I do not know how, came to the conclusion that Frenchmen were not rational, which served as the beginning of this chapter. And, do you know, I am impelled by something or other, while we are making our way to Paris, to let you know of my carriage thoughts, just like that, for the sake of human sympathy. After all, I was bored enough, sitting in that carriage, so you might as well be bored now. However, other readers should be protected, and I shall therefore deliberately include all these thoughts in one chapter, which I shall call Superfluous. I will bore you a little, but as it is superfluous, other people can simply leave it out. The reader must be treated carefully and conscientiously, but friends can be dealt with a little more cavalierly. Well now.